I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Ooh, I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and we are turning our attention this week on Eat Your Words to spirits, so you could say drink your words today. You know, it's actually finally freezing cold here in New York. I'm sitting here in my coat. There's a little coal wood-burning oven here, keeping everyone warm at Roberta's. It's pretty cozy, but you know, for all our complaining about this really warm winter, which it has been in New York City, it's finally cold. So, you know, what warms you up better than spirits? A neat, stiff drink, particularly moonshine, perhaps. So I have a book today. We're joined by the author of this book, and it is all about moonshine and love. And she's joining us on the phone from her home just outside of Asheville, North Carolina. Her name is Troy Ball. Are you there, Troy?
Yes, I am. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for joining us. So, Troy,
thank you.
This is a really wonderful book, but you are also the founder and principal of Troy & Sons. It is the, what do we call this? It is the makers of the first true American moonshine, quite an accomplishment. And this is your first book. It's a memoir. It's called Pure Heart, I should say, A Spirited Tale of Grace, Grit, and Whiskey. And and it is very much all that. But, you know, this book speaks about your life and your tremendous journeys and second chances. You started this company in your late 40s.
I did. I never would have thought I would have gotten into the whiskey making business, but here I am.
I mean, it's an incredible story, and I really want to, you know, talk to you about all aspects of it. But first, just to orient people a little bit about moonshine, you know, what makes this a quintessentially or, you know, the first true American moonshine?
Moonshine, you know, classically, historically, in the 1700s and all through the 1800s, actually, was made from grain, water, and yeast. No inclusion of sugar. And typically that grain, if you're from anywhere on the Appalachian chain of mountains up and down the East Coast, would have been made with corn, water, and yeast. That was the classic grain that they made moonshine from, because the old farm families were growing corn on their family farms, right? They were making bread, corn, and grits and things like that. And then they would take that same crop to make their whiskey. In our case, what we found is that the historic families, the heritage families, would use white corn because that was their preferred eating corn in the old days. And that white corn is what we use to make our whiskey today. We also use an heirloom white corn that survived since the mid-1800s called Crooked Creek corn. And it grows 12 feet tall. It puts about one ear of corn on per stalk. That's a very large ear of corn, like 12 to 14 inches sometimes. And that type of corn went out of fashion when the hybrids came in because it's a much lower yielding corn. You know, we only get about 60 bushels per acre, and a hybrid gets about 230 bushels per acre. So there went the old grains, unfortunately.
Right.
I got very lucky to have this one.
That's incredible. So it's a really unique type of corn, first and foremost. I think it's really amazing to see how long or how far back moonshine really goes. You talk about, you know, the Scotch-Irish settlers along the Appalachia bringing this tradition with them from the old world and using corn. And this was enjoyed long before Prohibition, but I think that Prohibition really gives moonshine its infamy, if you will. And it's known as a sort of coarse or unrefined drink due to these shortcuts people were taking during this time, right?
Yes, so that's exactly what happened.
Sort of corrupted.
You know, I think before Prohibition, moonshine would not have been called moonshine. That name
liquor.
Came out of Prohibition. Liquor, whiskey.
Okay.
And then when Prohibition was in place and they had to resort to cooking their whiskey in the middle of the night so they wouldn't get caught, so their fires wouldn't be seen, that's where the term moonshine came in. And really all the, you know, poor distillation techniques began because they were in a hurry and they didn't really care because they were just selling the stuff to try to make a quick buck because there was an instant market.
Yeah, they had standing orders for who knows how many, and then chaos ensued. I think it's a fascinating story. I loved learning that you are not the first female moonshine entrepreneur. You refer to a woman from the Prohibition era who traded moonshine and had diamond-studded teeth by the name of... This sounds like a true badass. Willie Sharp? What is that her name?
Willie Sharp. Yeah, I think she made really good money because she wasn't paying any tax on her moonshine, right?
Right.
I think those were the days, for sure. But, you know, the moonshine, I think it's important to note that prior to that period of time, people would have been making better quality spirits at home.
Right.
And the old men up here in the mountains outside of Asheville, they're the ones that basically taught me that there's a sweet spot in the distillation process.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about that.
And if you just grab the sweet spot, it's the pure heart of the distillation. And that whiskey from that part of the distillation is very smooth. It doesn't have any contaminants in it, no acetones and aldehydes and things that make the whiskey burn and give you headaches. And so those old-timers knew that, and they would just save that portion of the distillation for themselves, and then they'd mix the heads and tails together and sell it down the road, you know, to the fools.
So you're saying a sneakier way, or I guess a less quality way of making it would to be adding the distillation from all the different points, not just the pure heart. If I'm explaining that right.
And actually, to be honest with you, that's the way most whiskey in America is made. Uh-huh. It's made with 100% of the distillation basically mixed all together.
The impure.
And so you get the heads and the tails mixed in with the hearts. And sadly, many people think that whiskey has to burn. And it really doesn't. These men up here, they're drinking very, very smooth, lovely moonshine or pure hearts whiskey that doesn't burn because they were smart.
So you're trying to subvert the you know, the common misperceptions of moonshine, really, with bringing it back to this the purest form. That's really cool.
Yes, and what really kind of convinced me to get into this business was when I realized that there was this high-quality keeper kind of moonshine. That's what they called it. It's the keeper kind. I realized that that particular type of moonshine or white whiskey was not on the market. I mean, the only thing on the market in 2008 were some really rough, terrible products. So I thought, why aren't we making this really gorgeous white spirit and drinking American cocktails instead of Russian cocktails? Or Mexican, right? I mean, because this is our white spirit from America.
Yeah.
And when it's well made, gosh, it makes a gorgeous cocktail. So that's what drove me to start the business. I thought it was something really missing from our world here in America, and that it deserved to be brought to people's attention.
Yeah, and it's really part of the whole story of, the revival of American distilling heritage, which
yes.
is seeing a comeback. And I love the idea that, you know, this you're making it the keeper way, which it seems like this was mm-hmm. like a, you know, friends only, you know, a coveted secret mm-hmm. kind of stash.
Yes.
Maybe that's mm-hmm. why it didn't get around production too much.
No, that's right. It definitely was coveted. In fact, there was a little old lady who went into one of the liquor stores here in Marion, and she was buying a bottle of my Troy and Sons Platinum whiskey. Mm-hmm. And the guy working in the store said, "Hey, I haven't tasted that yet. Do you like it?" She looks at him and she says, "Oh, yeah." She says, "This is the kind you hide and keep mm-hmm. for yourself."
I'm sure you must have to.
I was so happy. I mean, that was the best review I ever could have gotten, in my opinion.
That is the true essence of this stuff. That is so fun. You must have to explain to people so much that, no, it's not going to hurt when you drink it.
Right.
That's so funny because, I mean, I think that, you know, it's a great story that you were bringing this back. And I know that you had to go through so much ordeals, going through all the Byzantine laws to get this produced. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little mm-hmm. bit about that and why it was so difficult to make it legal.
First of all, just getting a federal permit for a distillery is quite an ordeal.
Okay.
You know, it's hundreds of pages of documentation and applications and support that you have to generate. And you're supposed to have a distillery basically designed and built so that somebody can come inspect you from the state, from your state. They send someone to inspect your distillery. So you really have to make a serious investment in getting into the distilling business.
Yeah.
And so I spent about a year. Once I got a federal permit, I had it attached to this little farm out in Old Fort where this family had been growing this old heirloom corn that we use.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent almost a year in a little 18 by 18 foot barn building doing test distillations there. And we built different stills. Our first still was made with a pressure cooker,
mm-hmm.
Which was how one of the men made his whiskey down in Alabama I had met along the way. And it worked great.
Okay. Yeah.
and then the second still we made was with whiskey barrels. So we actually created steam in a big 100-gallon pot, and we popped that steam into a whiskey barrel that we had filled with mash.
Mm-hmm.
And the steam starts the mash boiling slow. It's a slow process, like hours and hours and hours.
Oh, my gosh.
But eventually, the steam causes the mash to start boiling, and then the vapor that comes off that mash is captured and piped into a second whiskey barrel.
Uh-huh.
That's called your thumper barrel. And it fills up with steam, and when it gets full of steam, it really legitimately thumps and makes a lot of noise, and you worry the whole thing's going to blow up.
Oh, my gosh.
And then the vapor leaves the thumper barrel and goes into a third barrel that we had a copper coil in, a 50-foot coil, submersed in cold water. And then the whiskey comes right out of the bottom of that barrel. We had a penetration through the bottom of the barrel where the copper could stick out. And so that vapor, when it hits the cold water and runs through the condensing coil, it condenses and turns to a liquid. And it was quite the adventure. So we
talk about experimentation.
Still.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah. And then I'd ordered a 60-gallon copper still from an outlaw guy in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of this renegade. I mean, really colorful guy, and he turned out to be so much help to me because he had been distilling, I think, for many, many years. And when I'd run into trouble, I could call him. His name is Colonel Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea if he served time, but I could say, "Colonel Wilson," I said, "I've got a problem here." And he'd say, "Well, what is it, little lady?" And I'd say, "Well," I said, "it's so cold outside. It's like 25 degrees outside, and I cannot keep the mash working because, you know, mash has to be,
boiling,
working at about 80 degrees. And he says, oh, that's a real simple fix, because I had the mash in 50-gallon barrels too, right?
Mm-hmm.
He goes, just go down to the pet store and get some aquarium heaters. Drop those in the mash and you'll be good to go.
Wow.
Can you believe that?
Oh, my gosh. And it worked?
So I go to the pet store and I order 10 aquarium heaters. They thought, oh, what is this? Is she going into competition or something? Anyway, that's how but you know, these people would help me to problem solve things all the time.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, it was just fantastic. Folks, it was my education.
That is incredible. And it worked, right? The heaters on that cold day?
Oh, my goodness. Actually, all of them worked. Mm-hmm. All three of those stills that we used in the little distillery out there all worked. And then what we were doing to sort of complicate everything and to really determine how to come up with our best recipe is we were buying different varieties of corn, yellow corns versus white corns, and we were milling them in different ways.
Okay.
So some were very finely milled, others were coarsely milled.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we used whole corn, sometimes we used sugar, sometimes we didn't. And so I was tracking every single batch of everything, and then we were trying to cross-reference the taste, like doing taste tests.
Sounds like a lot of drinking.
And then we also did different filtrations.
Mm-hmm.
So the old men, I asked John one day, John McIntyre owned the farm, I said, do you know how to make charcoal? And he starts laughing. He goes, well, no. He says, but I have a brother who used to be in the medical charcoal business.
Okay, well,
do you think you could ask him? And the next thing, I said, I'd like to make some charcoal out of cherry wood and out of, you know, sugar maple, some of these different woods, and see if we filter the whiskey through it, what it does to the flavor. And the next day I got out there, and John's like, Troy, I've got something for you. It's in the paper bag over there. He had a bag full of cherry wood charcoal that they had stayed up all night.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. And so then I'm like, okay, we got to go back to Lowe's because we need to build a cylinder that we can fill this charcoal in and then pour the whiskey through. And so we would go to Lowe's. We made 100 trips to Lowe's over that year. And we would build our own filtration device. So it was just great fun. It was great fun and spirited.
A community effort.
And also interesting, because there really is truly different flavor profiles you would get from these different recipes.
I can imagine. I know it sounds like something inherently, you know, a passed down tradition, not, you know, mass produced. There's a million ways to do it. And to produce,
and also you really can affect the flavor of the spirit based on how you run that still.
Mm.
So if the still is you're cooking it too hot, you're changing the flavor of the distillate. If you aren't running it through enough like plates, or if the vapor's not hitting enough surfaces. You change everything affects the flavor.
It's so different when you make something that is, you know, just a few batches. It can be inconsistent, and then you're trying to actually nail down the best flavor that you would like to present in each bottle. What a process.
Yeah.
What a process.
Yeah. People ask me all the time, well, how did it feel to be a woman in a man's business, you know?
Mm.
And I'd say, this was the most natural thing ever. I mean, this is cooking.
Yeah. And
I mean,
bring up Willie Sharp.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's really like making a big pot of oatmeal, cooking mash. And it was I felt perfectly at home doing all
tinkering,
that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I can't wait. I hope everyone gets a taste of Troy and Sons very soon. And we're going to talk much more after a quick little commercial break.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
All right, we're back chatting with Troy Ball. She is the author of Pure Heart, A Spirited Tale of Grace Grit and Whiskey, and the owner of Troy and Sons Moonshine. So, Troy, we were just talking a little bit about the history of moonshine. I just wanted to bring up, because there's so many colorful words for moonshine that are peppered throughout this book. So maybe you've heard it by the name of White Lightning. There's one. Yeah. And there's Mountain Dew. Of course, this is before the soda came out. Mm-hmm. We talked about Pure Heart, which is that sweet spot in the distillation process. And then there is a 24-hour punch, which is something else from the heyday of sort of prohibition moonshine drinking, which is where you, and it's deceptively strong because it tastes like citrus. You 24-hour soak, or what do you call it? What do you call it?
Infused, yes. The fruit,
citrus in there, and then there's let's have a spider leg, which refers
a spider leg. A little spider leg is the little when you swirl the cup and you get kind of like you do with wine, and you get the little legs running down the sides of the whiskey glass. So it seems like it's just a little bit. The old men would say, oh, let's just have a little spider leg. Like it's just a tiny little bit, but really they didn't mean that.
right. Okay. So, or have
and,
two.
And also liquor, L-I-K-K-E-R. I mean, that's the way the local people would spell it. They often called it liquor.
And I love that you paint a really rich portrait of the Appalachian culture, and is actually gaining a bit of interest in the food world, this region for its heritage, and being it was cut off from the rest of the country a bit by railroads for quite a while until you write this wonderful history until one of the Vanderbilts decided to build the largest residence in the U.S. The Biltmore Mansion. And it brought in a whole city of help and its own railway stop to this mansion. And it is still the largest mansion. And that really changed, and it's kind of ushered in the industrialization, at least outside of Asheville, in Asheville.
I think the Biltmore estate really influenced Asheville as a town and region, because they brought in all these artisans from around the country and from Europe to work on the construction of this home, which was the largest in North America, actually. And then after the home was finished, many of those people settled here. Mm-hmm. So, Asheville's very rich in the arts, but all sorts of ironworking and woodworking and weaving and clay, and it's just a rich cultural area here, and the food is fantastic as well. We're a region that I think really likes to appreciate its local foods, particularly heirloom variety of foods.
Right. Somebody was still growing in that corn.
Heirloom hogs I raised.
Oh, really? Wow.
Because I had all this corn mash, I thought, well, shoot, we should be not just getting rid of it. We should be feeding it to livestock like George Washington did at his distillery, literally outside of the door of the distillery where the farm is.
What are you going to do with that, mash? It's great nutrition for livestock.
Yeah. And 3% alcohol, the hogs are happy. But it's so nice to be in a town that appreciates all these heirloom foods.
Yeah.
We also mill our corn, Crooked Creek corn, into grits, and they're sold around town here and found in some of the restaurants and in stores.
Wow. Yeah, it's a fascinating story of revival and closely kept tradition still going. I think that it was really interesting to read about how Prohibition really wiped out the economy. And so the downtowns were just dilapidated and became a shell. And then you write that the activists slowly, created a culture starting from the 70s on. And then it created a really unique culture there because it was, depressed. It was the whole city was in debt by millions.
Well, what had happened was in like the 1920s when the Great Depression happened, Asheville had, $70 million or something in debt. They had really taken on a lot of debt to do some major development work in downtown. Mm-hmm. And so rather than filing bankruptcy, as many cities did around the country, they just dug in their heels. They said, we're going to pay off all this debt. And it took them the next 50 years to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And so the good thing about all that was the downtown ended up boarded up largely until the 80s. And all the buildings were preserved. So we missed that 1960s and 70s thing of let's come in and tear down the old buildings and build, unattractive buildings. Asheville's very intact in terms of retaining all of that early 1920s architecture and 30s and even earlier. So it makes it a very pretty town. And then there was a man named Julian Price who had inherited quite a lot of money, and he wanted to revitalize downtown. So they formed a company called Public Interest Projects, which basically would lend money to young entrepreneurs who wanted to bring business into downtown Asheville. And they would, it was cheap money, and they would help these businesses understand their financial situation. They would meet with them every month, and they would advise them and coach them so that they could learn to be successful business people. And it worked perfectly. And I truly think if there hadn't been Julian Price and Public Interest Project, Asheville would have been a much longer time revitalizing.
Mm-hmm. And you also write that it was sort of your business and other distilleries sort of rode this wave of the interest in craft beer brewing, and that's that making a comeback in these parts and also throughout America for that matter. So it's really exciting to see this building momentum and with businesses like yours.
It is, and I was very fortunate. I became friends with Oscar Wong, who was the founder of Highland Brewing Company, was the first brewery in Asheville. And that's saying a lot because, Asheville's been like Beer City USA for, I think, 5 years straight.
Wow.
And Oscar became a lovely, wonderful mentor to me. And he had been in craft beer from the beginning. And he said, look, I made a lot of mistakes. I bought the wrong equipment or undersized equipment. He said, you need to do it this way, Troy. And he ended up actually investing in my distillery as the first investor.
That's great.
So that was amazing to have a mentor like that.
Yeah. Now, we are almost out of time, but it's so funny that we didn't talk too much about your other project that you founded, which is the Thoughtful House Center for Children in Austin, Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Which is now called Johnson Center for Child Health and Development. And
That's the Johnson family out of New York. It was renamed for them because they became the big benefactors of Thoughtful House. Thoughtful House is an autism treatment and research center for children with autism and on the spectrum. And I was one of the founders, and I think it sees, well over 3,000 children a year now, maybe many more than that even. And we did some of the early medical research on vaccines, basically, because there was all that controversy about whether vaccines were affecting children and turning on autism. So we did the first ever primate studies on the full regime of childhood vaccines. Can you believe that had never been done?
Yeah. And it's such
they had tested each vaccine individually, but they had never tested them
for
you're going to get three today and three next month, and you know, and you're going to do them all within this many years. So that had never been looked at, and we took a deep dive look at that and came up with some really disturbing findings as it related to the primates. So I don't know. I just tried to, you know, I had two special needs sons. I have two special needs sons and a third son who's adopted. And I just had to spend the first 25 years of my life trying to keep the boys alive. And that's why as I came across this idea of creating Thoughtful House, I went ahead and did it because it was something I could feel good about and felt like it might make a difference for a lot of people. And I couldn't be out there in the real world, you know, working a normal job or creating a business because I was too tied to trying to keep the guys alive.
Yeah.
And anyway, I was told they wouldn't live past the age of
their
10,
teenage, right.
And they're like 30 and 28 now, so we're doing good.
Well, you know, reading the first few chapters of your book, it's so touching and so sensitive, and you can really see why later in life, you know, coming up with all your processes for making moonshine is no sweat after all the determination and strength, you know, you went through raising your children.
Yes, you're exactly right. It's so difficult to live under the stress of medically fragile children who are undiagnosed, and it makes you become super strong. You have to. For them.
Absolutely.
And so nothing else really matters. It's very difficult after that. You'll just take on anything without being too worried about it.
You seem to be endowed with superhuman strength and compassion and courage, really.
I've done the best I can. I hope the book tells the story well.
It's beautifully written.
That was my goal.
I'm so glad that you shared this book. I know it's I was trying to describe it to people. I'm like, well, it's a book about whiskey and a life.
And motherhood.
Yeah, motherhood.
And also financial disaster.
And entrepreneurship. And I think anyone who's an entrepreneur, whether it's spirits or something else, can learn a lot from this. So
it's a great tale. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
It's great to have me on.
Well, thanks so much for a great chat about it. I hope everyone gets their hands on Pure Heart, just out now from Day Street Press. It's written by Troy Ball. Thank you again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Ooh, I like the way you do.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.